Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Something is wrong with American elections. Politicians are racing to choose their voters instead of the other way around, and our democracy hangs in the balance. Every 10 years, redistricting occurs based on population shifts revealed by the census. But in advance of this year's midterms, the race is on in several states to draw new districts to favor one party or the other. In South Carolina, a state that has historically avoided mid-cycle redraws, there is a move that, if successful, could wipe out that state's only solidly Democratic district and make it Republican. That would seriously jeopardize longtime Congressman Jim Clyburn's chances for re-election. Meanwhile, in North Carolina, the legislature is proposing several constitutional amendments for November's ballot, two of which would impact taxes, both income and property taxes. It may seem like a bargain, but because it is a constitutional amendment, some say it is also a move for the GOP to put its stamp on how the state operates for generations to come. Today, a discussion about all this and more with Gavin Jackson. He is a host and public affairs reporter for South Carolina Public Radio and South Carolina ETV. He joins us along with Colin Campbell, Capitol Bureau Chief and political reporter at WUNC. And Dr. Chris Cooper's here. He's professor and director of the Public Policy Institute at Western Carolina University and author of Anatomy of a Purple State. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for being here.
Morning.
I'm going to begin with you, Gavin, in South Carolina, because that's where the big news is happening right now. There was big activity in the state legislature over the weekend on Saturday. The state Senate considered new maps. Where did this move begin? With the legislature, with the governor, or with Donald Trump?
All the above, but we'll start with Donald Trump, especially because that's been the latest push. Because if we rewind to the beginning of this legislative session, Mike, redistricting was not on the radar. We asked all the leadership. We talked to the House Speaker. We talked to the Senate Majority Leader. No one wanted to do redistricting. It was not a priority. That changed after April 29th with the U.S. Supreme Court decision on Louisiana v. Calais. That gave a little bit of a bump here to efforts that were really just far-right efforts throughout the session. They wanted to see some changes to the maps, but folks that have looked at the maps were never crazy about changing them because of the fact that ours is constitutional. The U.S. Supreme Court upheld our current congressional map in a decision in 2024, ruling that it was a constitutional gerrymander, not a racial gerrymander like what we saw in the Louisiana case. So you take that factor into consideration when all of a sudden, after the April 29th decision, things started rumbling in South Carolina in the final weeks of the legislative session that led to bills getting filed, pressure from the White House. You had the President Donald Trump calling folks, including Senate Majority Leader Shane Massey, to try and take up redistricting in an effort to get one more seat out of our congressional map. That's currently six Republicans to one Democrat, like you said, Congressman Clyburn in the 6th District. So that was a big push. Lawmakers failed to get that into a sine die resolution, which would have dictated what they can do after the adjourned session May 14th. That was stopped by the Senate. You needed two-thirds, and a couple of Republicans decided they did not want to take that up in session. And so then the governor intervened, called a special session, and that's where we're at right now. Even though the governor said, let's leave it up to the lawmakers to decide this, after they decided not to come back, he decided to call them back in an incredibly rare move that we haven't seen in years.
This appears to be where this is happening all over the country, appears to be an attempt to maintain control of the House and Senate in the midterm election, something that is a threat for any party that controls the White House in the midterm. It's particularly transparent, it seems to me, because the effort to go after one seat seems extraordinary. But that one seat is held by Jim Clyburn, who is responsible in large part for electing Joe Biden. Do you think that played a role in this?
Not necessarily. I think they just want to get every district that they can get in all seven of them and try and make that map red all across. But a lot of folks, including Shane Massey and other senators, Republicans, say that's not guaranteed with this map that was just handed down from Washington. The Republican Redistricting Trust drew this map. It went right through the House, right through the Senate Judiciary Committee. Again, limited public input on this map. No public hearings besides the three hearings by those committees. And it's just been rushed. I mean, lawmakers haven't even been able to tinker with this map. They don't have the staff or the equipment to do that like they typically would, which would take months. And right now, a lot of people are also saying, hey, you might want to get rid of Clyburn now, but in 2 years or in the next administration, there could be a Democrat in the White House. And when that happens, you want someone like Jim Clyburn in your style, in your stable, calling up DC and trying to get things done, like the Charleston Harbor Deepening Project, for example, or any number of spending projects that could benefit South Carolina. So it cuts both ways, and a lot of people know that. And meanwhile, they're just going headfirst into trying to make this map all red, which is still up for debate.
A lot of activity over the weekend. It seemed to be pretty rushed because, if I understand this correctly, they lawmakers opted to advance this bill ahead of schedule rather than continue debating through the night and through the holiday weekend. And they're coming back today at 11 o'clock, so they won't vote on this measure until today or tomorrow. And interestingly enough, in South Carolina, early voting is underway even as we speak. It began this morning, correct?
Yeah, that's right, Mike. I'm actually at an early voting location. There's like 75 people lined up already to vote when I was here starting at 8:30. And I talked to several folks, and a lot of people are really educated on what's going on with the redistricting effort. And no one's for this, of course. A lot of folks are against it, especially here in Columbia, which is a Democratic city. But yeah, that over the weekend, we almost had to go in session all weekend. There was a bit of a compromise that pretty much saved the amendments and the debate for today, starting today. There was a second reading vote, but this bill needs third reading. And also, since it's a reapportionment bill, there's some more arcane rules that prevent debate from happening until the third day of a debate. So they're gonna go in today, and there's gonna be probably an early vote to see if Republicans have the votes to invoke cloture, which would limit debate to up to an hour per member. That's up to 46 hours, but we would expect about 12 to 15 hours being used by the 12 Democrats and however many Republicans that want to speak there too. So the votes are there to invoke cloture and to limit this debate. You need 26. There are 34 Republicans in there, but we've seen some squishiness. It's hard to tell if it's actually going to go through, but I think it will. But at the same time, a lot of people are concerned about this early voting and how that will weigh on a future court case, which we know will be dropped immediately whenever the governor signs this map into law. We've been told there are lawsuits ready to be filed when it comes to disenfranchising voters and causing voter confusion. Because while the rest of the ballot currently will be counted, if this map and legislation gets passed, the congressional vote will be thrown out and there'll be a new congressional primary rescheduled till mid-August. So the average voter probably doesn't know much about that, and they're going to be confused when they wake up in August and realize that they have a different congressman, and the person that was maybe campaigning in their district is no longer running for Congress. There's a lot of ins and outs here that have really not been thoroughly vetted because it only has been 3 weeks.
Well, given that voters are standing at polling locations right now making decisions, is this legal?
I mean, it technically is, I suppose. I mean, that will be something for the court to decide. I mean, the state house, the lawmakers, all 170 of them do have the power to draw these maps. Typically, that's done every 10 years. And at the same time, like we said, ours is was ruled constitutional back in 2024. So I think the bigger question will be what the court decides on striking this down and whether that means on what grounds that'll be to be determined. But yeah, I mean, it's legal up until it's not legal, I would say. We see what happens, but they're trudging ahead like it is. And of course, the big concern is too, there's been absentee ballots being cast. There's been military ballots being returned. But I think the in-person voting is really a different level when it comes to what this might mean for disenfranchisement, especially when you make a court case going forward.
Yeah, I want to talk about these absentee ballots because many of them have already come. Well, they have already come in. Well, many of them have, and we'll talk about that in a second. It's difficult to talk about maps on the radio because you can't see
Sure.
them. But the proposed map appears to split counties near us. Lancaster and York, which used to be in one county in our listening area, is now being split up. And most of the counties bordering North Carolina would also be changing their districts. You mentioned that Columbia is a Democratic city, very much like Charlotte, and this is a Republican effort. But do we know what kind of support or lack of support this move has among South Carolinians across the state?
Well, it's really kind of mixed, and I think it is more of a messaging issue because, you talk to some of the Republicans who are in the opposition to this, and they say, when I explain the fact that this is going to cost upwards of $6 million, might not actually give the Republicans an advantage, could actually dilute their vote, also spreads out districts like you're saying, and also causes some confusion. I mean, it's I think once you explain this very complex topic that the average person's not really concerned about, Then they will say, why are we doing this? But the average person, or maybe a more Republican voter who's more maybe more MAGA, is just being told over and over again and seen over and over again on social media and other outlets that they need to do this to get all seven districts, regardless of what it costs. You have some folks who have testified who said, hey, we have super majorities in both the House and the Senate. Why aren't we acting like it? It's that DC mentality that is now creeping into South Carolina that you have a handful of Republican senators, including the majority leader, are saying, we don't need this right now. We don't have the time to do this. Our maps are constitutional. This will cause disenfranchisement. It's going to cost money. And at the same time, we can't even guarantee that it's going to give us a 7-0 sweep, and it might dilute voter shares across the state. Well, again, we are a growing state like North Carolina, and these maps are based off of the 2020 census, which was done during COVID. Not the most reliable census, no shame there, but you have districts like the 7th congressional district, our latest ad, is now going to be essentially the 1st congressional district. So you got Myrtle Beach down the coast, down the Grand Strand, into Charleston on the peninsula. You have folks that are like, these are two different areas. Yes, there's a lot of transplants in those areas, but they are two different areas entirely when it comes to folks trying to get federal funding for those areas. So there's a lot of splits. There's a lot of weirdness. There's a billboard at the base of the Ravenel Bridge in Charleston advertising Representative Mark Smith, who was running in the 1st congressional district for a Republican nomination. And that billboard is no longer in the 1st congressional district. So he has to consider trying to get, if this goes through, they have to talk to new constituents in different parts of the state that they did not target initially. So this is going to also backfire on some of these candidates too. And of course, low voter turnout in the August primary.
Dr. Chris Cooper is also with us from Western Carolina University, and there has been talk around the country where these redistricting efforts are being pushed by Republicans that this may backfire on them. That when you make all your districts favor Republicans, what you're doing is diluting. You're
Sure.
moving Democrats into Republican districts and diluting the power of Republicans. Explain that to me, because they're saying that that might threaten the end result might be the exact opposite of what these legislators are hoping for. How does that work?
Yeah. Absolutely. So, I mean, when you gerrymander, you redistrict, right? You don't make voters disappear. You just spread them out more inefficiently or less efficiently. And so the argument here is, imagine, you're spreading some jelly on a piece of toast. Eventually, it gets just too thin. And so if they cut it too thin, if they spread it too thin, the idea is that in a wave election like 2026, maybe for the Democrats may actually get more seats. So people call this, actually the technical term, believe it or not, is called a dummy mander. And it comes from a very arcane political science book chapter written by a couple of folks. But the idea that some folks are saying is this could truly be a dummy mander. Now, my guess is, even if this is a dummy mander in 2026, where the Democrats expect to do better, in 2028, which we expect to be a worse year for Democrats, it's probably going to go back the other way. So it's not that it's much ado about nothing. It's just that I think it depends whether you've got a short-term or a long-term perspective on exactly what these maps are going to do.
So when voters look at this, obviously the pure partisans are going to like what they see, but there are going to be a lot of people in the middle, and that's where we're told most people are. Do they see this as anything more than a pure power grab by Republicans, anything more than pure politics? Chris.
I don't know that they do, but I don't know that it matters actually. So, Winthrop University, Scott Huffman there has done a lot of really good polling on this. And basically, what he finds is, yeah, nobody loves gerrymandering. Nobody says, yeah, I'd actually like to see more gerrymandering in my state. But that doesn't mean that they're necessarily going to hold their party accountable for it. And the reason is that everybody thinks that the other party does it too. Like, let's look at Virginia and what the Democrats are doing there.
Right. We have to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk more about what's happening in South Carolina right now. Actually, by 11 o'clock, when the legislature comes back in session, it'll be happening again, this debate over redistricting. And we'll talk about that in a minute. It's Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Gavin Jackson. He's a host and public affairs reporter for South Carolina Educational Television and for South Carolina Public Radio. He's here along with Dr. Chris Cooper, professor at Western Carolina University and director of the Public Policy Institute there. And Colin Campbell will join us shortly. He's with WUNC when we talk about North Carolina politics in a moment. Gavin, Democratic State Senator Russell Ott from Calhoun, Calhoun County promises he and other Democrats, along with people that he describes as courageous Republicans, his words, will keep pushing against this measure today when they come back into session. Do Democrats have a shot? Or if it fails, will it merely be a timing issue? In other words, will Democrats be responsible for any movement on this?
Well, they're definitely trying to get a couple of Republican senators to jump over and block that cloture vote so it happens.
I think we're losing.
Have been saying that.
Gavin, I think we're losing you. I'm not sure why, because you were fine in the first segment, but now you're breaking up. Can you turn off your video? Maybe that will help us a little bit. I don't know whether that'll work or not. Try again. Well, we've lost Gavin. So we will move on to other topics here as we go through the hour here. And maybe we'll try to get Gavin back and finish our conversation about what's happening down there in the South Carolina today, because they invoked cloture on Saturday to shorten debate. They're going to try to do it again today, we are told. But Orangeburg Democrat Brad Hutto says that will be a tough decision because people that vote for cloture on Tuesday are actually voting to disenfranchise voters who are standing in the line at the polls at the very time that the vote will be taken. I'm curious, Chris, if this is unprecedented. Has this happened elsewhere in the country ever?
Yeah, look, this is not unprecedented. We have seen things like this. Heck, we've actually seen reruns of elections entirely, right? The 9th Congressional District in North Carolina certainly comes to mind. But I think what's going to happen is, obviously, as Gavin said before, there's going to be lawsuits no matter what happens here. A lot of ways that lawsuit's going to go, but one of the arguments is certainly going to be this violates what people call the Purcell Principle. The idea behind the Purcell Principle is, hey, once you're really close to an election, you probably shouldn't be messing with it because it messes with voters too much. It's more complicated than that, but that's essentially the bottom line. And so that Purcell principle has been invoked to stop election changes that happen just a couple of days or even weeks before an election that's already started, we could be looking at something very, very different. So I expect that to be maybe the first line of legal attack that's going to happen if and when these maps pass.
Gavin Jackson is back with us. We were talking about whether Democrats will have any impact on this, and I mentioned that Senator Russell Ott, the Democrat from Calhoun, promises that he and courageous Republicans will do their best. But if this measure fails, Gavin, will it be because of anything Democrats did, or will it simply be because Republicans are going to look at what's happening at the polls right now today and think this is not a good thing?
Yeah, I mean, if it fails, the Democrats have done everything they can. They're putting up about 100 amendments. Everyone's going to be able to talk for up to an hour. So that's at least 12 hours right there with Democrats filibustering. If they do invoke cloture, if they don't get enough Republicans to say, no, we shouldn't be doing this as thousands of South Carolinians vote early, as thousands of votes have already been returned absentee and from the military. I mean, these are arguments that we heard from some very prominent Republicans trying to sound the alarm here, despite what they heard from the president pushing for this. Again, if this would have made a little bit more sense months ago, but no one had any desire to do this months ago because they realized that this really was the best map that they have. I mean, this thing has been redistricted to hell, essentially. I mean, they've got the best they can get, and now they're trying to get some more juice out of this, and it's still to be determined. So, you know, I think a lot of folks are against this entire process, the way it's been expedited and just crammed through. But Democrats say, you know, there might be a silver lining if they want to make these districts more competitive, they are ready to fight for them. So it could backfire, like we were talking about, in terms of if there is a blue wave, that could really mess things up for the Republicans there. And a lot of these guys will say, I told you so. But again, it's hard to really message this because redistricting is so weird and complicated and wonky that the average person, the average Republican voter, just hears, oh, President Trump wants you to do this. Why aren't the Republicans in the State House doing this? And so far, they are on track to do this today after some extended debate if they do not get cloture. If they
Early voting has been going on for a while, and you mentioned, I think, more than 4,000 absentee ballots have already been received by the Election Commission there. More than 13,000 of those ballots have been mailed out. 322 military ballots have been received. What happens to those votes if redistricting goes through? Do they have to vote again?
Yes, and that's going to be the same for folks voting in person, the same thing for folks voting on June 9th on Election Day, that The ballot itself will count. Everything will count on that ballot except for the congressional district race. So that will be tossed, and they won't even show us those results, is what we're being told. And then there'll be a new primary in August on the 18th. And filing for that primary opens on June 1st through the 5th, another kind of big deadline there that's looming. And we've heard from election officials who are saying this is going to be a monumental task. So then, not only are you talking about confused voters, but you're talking about reliability issues, potential reliability issues too, that will come into play when these overworked county election offices will have to turn around after the runoffs, potential runoffs on June 23rd, create new ballots and send them out and get ready for the August elections.
So let's be clear. Some of these ballots are cast by military people who were scattered all over the world. Other people may not be in a position to vote again, absentee, or even go to the polls. So you're saying that they've been disenfranchised. Their votes already cast would be discarded.
Yeah, and it's not just me. It's what other folks, including Majority Leader Shane Massey, have said in terms of their big reasons as to not doing this and why they are against doing this. It's one of many. But yeah, those will have, they'll have to get new ballots. They'll be sent out. Hopefully, they'll be ready to go. But again, it's going to be a very confusing, complex process that if it has to be done perfectly in order for it to work. And we all know how elections can be sometimes, and that's a pretty high hurdle.
You just mentioned Shane Massey. For those listeners in North Carolina who don't know who he is, he's from Edgefield. He is the Senate Majority Leader, and he's a Republican. And I guess we live in a state where Phil Berger has been the Senate Majority Leader forever. He too is a Republican, and he kind of rules with an iron fist. So if the Senate Majority Leader, a Republican, is opposed to this move, how did it ever make it to the floor?
Well, it shouldn't have made it to the floor because they, like I said earlier, they blocked that resolution to be able to take this up in special session. They didn't have enough votes. You needed two-thirds. They didn't have that. And so we thought this issue was dead until the governor turned around and called a special session for this issue. Then it zoomed through the House and it's going through the Senate right now. And this is something that he has let his members kind of take their own direction on. Unlike the House and unlike some other states, the Senate's not up for re-election this year. So they have a bit of cover compared to the House where their lawmakers are up, specifically 24 Republicans. So they had a little bit more incentive to kind of get this through and not be targeted by the White House in their upcoming elections on the 9th. So concerns there versus what's going on in the Senate.
Shane Massey also says there are voting precincts included in this proposed map that no longer exist, and he attributed that to the rush process of getting this through. Does that mean that the map is flawed from the get-go?
Hard to say because we have not gotten details on this map. It was handed down by Washington. There has been really no vetting on that. And that's not just me talking. That's those members of the General Assembly who typically have full control over this process and they have ceded that power to Washington. Yes, federalism is probably dead in the state of South Carolina, but some of these Republicans are saying, over my dead body. And then, we have a picture of John C. Calhoun in our Senate chamber. And they're looking at him saying, guys, what happened to states' rights here? I mean, yes, our guy's in the White House, but at what point do we just cede control to Washington and just take what they give us without even putting up a fight? This bill has a lot of concerns. There's a lot of split precincts where one precinct is going to be two different congressional districts, which is something that they try to typically avoid when they make these maps. There's a lot of concerns here. And I think when it came to those precincts that he was talking about, there's been some naming changes and some confusion. Which again, when I'm telling you about having to do this August primary and hoping everything goes perfectly, we're already showing that the map is not perfect. So there's a lot of reliability questions that are going to come as a result of this that could have wide-ranging implications that we have not even thought of right now.
And Republican Chip Campson, who represents Isle of Palms and who helped draw the existing voting map, says he's convinced this will blow up in the faces of Republicans who are pushing this through, and that the state Supreme Court, he believes, will strike it down. And he added he doesn't even know who drew this map. Nationally, observers are watching for many reasons, not the least of which is that if this map passes, this new map would put in serious jeopardy the seats held since 1992 by Democrat James Clyburn, who is currently the only Democratic U.S. House member in the South Carolina delegation. Some have referred to this move as Jim Crow 2.0. Are there political and/or optical ramifications to this if it happens?
Yeah, I think like we were talking earlier, Mike, in terms of the power of Jim Clyburn, not only is he a kingmaker when it comes to presidential primaries, which is right around the corner in 2028, and who knows what ramifications this will have as a result, but Clyburn's annual fish fry is coming up this Friday. He's going to have Ro Khanna there, Congressman Ro Khanna, and Andy Beshear, will be talking as well, the Kentucky governor. So, I mean, you have these potentials already coming through the state. And again, Clyburn is one of those helpful congressmen that really gets things done when it comes to having a, if there's a Democrat in the White House, especially one that he helped get elected there, you see some perks as a result, just like Republicans do when it comes to having Trump in the White House with Senator Lindsey Graham. I mean, it cuts both ways, and smart politicians know that. They probably don't like to admit that, but they know that that's how it works. And Chip Campson, who you mentioned, also has said in the previous debate over that map, the previous hearings that that map had in court, saying it's an advantage to have Congressman Clyburn represent his district and then having another congressman represent other areas nearby. I mean, you get a benefit from this when it comes to trying to get some federal funding and attention, especially when you have places like Joint Base Charleston, you have a growing residential population down there, up and down the coast, and you have other military installations in and around the area. I mean, it really pays off, especially when you're talking about the port, like that Congressman Clyburn has helped get money for the deepening project there. So, yes, this could have some negative ramifications if you just get rid of Clyburn and hope for the best with the Republicans.
You look at a national map of the country, and you'll see that North Carolina and South Carolina are painted blood red. Chris Cooper says we're a purple state, which we can talk about in a second. What about South Carolina? It's been gerrymandered to a fare-thee-well. Is it a red state or is it a purple state?
It is a red state stuck between two purple states, and as far as we know, that's how it's going to stay. Especially with the influx of folks coming into our state, even though you would think that might change some political dynamics, I think it gets canceled out a little bit too, because a lot of Republicans from up north do like to settle into the Grand Strand area. You get a little bit more of that down in the Charleston area too. As well as the upstate. So we've still seen very strong statewide margins when it comes to these races in terms of electing the governor, who's also on the ballot this year, and also the president. We've seen just these strong margins that are hard to beat, like 10, 12, 14-point margins there for Republicans. So it's still a very strong Republican state here. But that could change. And I think you're seeing some concerns about that in terms of why they're really pushing to get this Republican map pushed us through as well.
Gavin Jackson is host of This Week in South Carolina on SCE TV. He's also a public affairs reporter for both television and South Carolina radio, public radio. Thank you for joining us this morning. I appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
You're welcome. Moving on to Colin Campbell, Capitol Bureau Chief of WUNC, and Dr. Chris Cooper, Professor of Public Policy at the Western Carolina University and Director of the Public Policy Institute there. Chris, it seems silly to redistrict an entire state as an election is underway to pick up one seat, is it?
Is it bad for democracy? Is it bad for
Yes, it's, well,
representation?
we know it's
Yes.
bad for democracy, but is it
Right.
silly?
Is it silly? No. I mean, I guess it depends on your definition of silly, right? But no, I think this is, if they are able to get this through, it's going to work, and it's going to signal that they, meaning the Republican Party in South Carolina, is on the side of President Trump. And that appears to be the way to get things from Washington. I mean, we saw what happened when Trump went after John Cornyn, for example, in Texas, and certainly the back and forth between Tom Tillis and Donald Trump right now. So no, I don't think it's silly. I think it's likely to work if they can get it through. I think the problem they've got is, again, like Gavin said very well, early voting started today. I'm actually in South Carolina at the beach right now while we're having this conversation, and about half a mile away from me, there is an early voting place, and there's already people out there casting those votes. I think that's going to be their problem. I think the odds of a true dummy mander here are actually pretty low, kind of like we saw in North Carolina with the first congressional district.
Is this likely to diminish turnout, early voting turnout, if voters know this is going on even as they speak and that their votes may not count or that some of them may not count? Is what's the likely outcome of
Absolutely.
that?
Confusion is the enemy of voter turnout, right? And I cannot imagine a more confusing scenario than this. You're going to vote under current maps, but those maps might or might not be different maps later. And then when you actually show up and vote in those, you'd have something else entirely going on. This is tailor-made for low voter turnout. And I think that is exactly what we're likely to see.
South Carolina is not alone in this move, Colin. We did this, but we did it before the election. We did it in October of last year, and it passed this, our new map passed strictly along party lines. How might that affect the outcome of the midterms in November here?
Yeah, similar to what we're seeing in South Carolina, we're really only looking at one congressional district that shifted as a result of the redistricting that took place last fall, and that's the first congressional district up in the northeastern corner of the state. Always has been a pretty competitive district where Democrat Don Davis holds that seat. Under the new maps, it shifts a little bit more towards Republicans, but Davis is still running. Most folks are not counting him out. He's overperformed his party in past election cycles, so there's still a chance that he could pull this off and keep that seat in Democratic hands. So while it gets a little bit easier for Republican Lori Buckout to win that seat as a result of redistricting, it's not necessarily a slam dunk for Republicans. But like you said, that took place last year, was not sort of connected to these court decisions about the Voting Rights Act. It was more a matter of sort of answering President Trump's call to redraw districts in red states or states controlled by Republicans to give a few more seats here and there to Republican in the congressional races.
I said in the very beginning that something is wrong with American elections. There are many things wrong with American elections, not what Donald Trump alleges, but this is one of those things, politicians drawing the map to choose their voters and not the other way around. And I'm wondering if this is viewed by voters, Colin, strictly through partisan lenses. If you are a Republican voter, this is a good idea. If you're a Democratic voter, this is a bad idea, at least in North and South Carolina. Or do they see it for what it is?
I think most people probably see it for what it is. Certainly, the hardcore partisans are cheering on their party's redistricting efforts, whether it's Republicans here in North Carolina or Democrats trying to redistrict at this point unsuccessfully north of us in Virginia. But North Carolina, the fastest growing and the largest number of registered voters is now unaffiliated. And so I think a lot of people look at the sort of partisan hijinks and efforts to sort of increase the electoral chances of one party at the expense of the other is just another sign that politics is not working too well in this United States of America right now.
I have about 30 seconds, Chris. We've had gerrymandering for a very long time, centuries. But now we have Citizens United. We have other pressures on the election system. Are we witnessing the demise of democracy?
Slowly. And I think it's not gone yet. I think we still have a chance to try to rescue it. If you look at what's happening here versus what's happening in Virginia, it's a hot mess, regardless of which political party you belong to. So kind of now's the time.
When we come back, we're going to talk about some other Republican political moves that are happening in North Carolina as we go into the midterm era. But these have to do with something we may vote on this November that you probably never thought about before this year. That is constitutional amendments. We'll get to that in a moment.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the British International School of Charlotte, offering an international curriculum and IB diploma program for high school students designed to help prepare them for college, careers, and a global community. BISCharlotte.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. So we're here with Colin Campbell, Capitol Bureau Chief for WUNC, and Dr. Chris Cooper, Professor and Director of the Public Policy Institute at Western Carolina University. Colin, since taking control of the General Assembly for the first time in about 100 years, Republicans have pursued a strategy to find ways to lower and or cap taxes. What has been the result of that thus far?
Well, so far we've seen significantly lower personal income tax rates and corporate income tax rates in the state, and that sort of by design reduced the size of state government. We've seen the amount of revenue coming from that tax source shrink over time as we've gone from a rate, in the 7% range down to around 3% now, or around 4% now. We're about to go lower as a result of some triggers that have been put into state law. And that's likely not to change over the coming years. Republicans really would like to see us eventually do away with income taxes entirely. The plan is for the corporate income tax rate to completely phase out over the next few years. And Republicans are hoping, probably not happening anytime between now and the 2030s at this point, but to do similar with our income tax rate in the state and sort of mirror some other Republican-led states that don't have an income tax, like Tennessee has come up in discussion. So a pretty big shift in how North Carolina funds its government and how people are taxed in the
So
state.
where will the money come from if they're successful at doing that? Because you have to have money to pay employees and insurance policies and to build roads and do all the other things that state governments do. Where will the money come from? And in those states that have done this, what has been the outcome?
It does result in sort of smaller state government. I mean, we're already at a point in this state where you've got a lot of state agencies like the prison system that have heavy vacancy rates because the pay for some of these jobs is not competitive enough to fill them with people who want to do the job. You're seeing, you know, shifts in public school funding in this state as a result. What's interesting is there's other, you know, sources of funding. And we asked legislative leaders just last week, are you considering any restrictions on sales tax, for example? Obviously, a more regressive form of taxation, but another key source of revenue for state and local governments. And they said, no, absolutely not. We're not considering any reductions on that. So I think you're going to see a shift towards other things. I mean, you're already seeing a shift towards, at the local level, higher property taxes to perform some of the functions that previously the state was funding. So, you know, I've heard lawmakers describe this as a balloon. And you kind of, if you squeeze one revenue source, you're going to have pressure to, you know, look for more revenue from a different source. And I think that's perhaps where we're headed as we push away from using the income taxes.
But at the same time, as local governments are trying to find ways to replace the money not coming in from state government as they cut taxes and cut support for the local governments, they're also considering a constitutional amendment to cap property taxes in the future, which county managers, including our own in Mecklenburg County, are very concerned about because it will limit their options should things go awry. How can you do both things at the same time? There has to be money to fund services, doesn't there?
Yes, and the argument you hear from Republican legislative leaders is, well, we've cut these tax rates, and because the state is growing so fast, we've still seen our revenues grow. Of course, the years that they've been in power since 2011, we haven't had the kind of recession we saw in 2008. So I think some of these sort of fiscal policies have not been stress tested yet. But certainly the argument we're hearing from Republicans as well, you know, we're generating more economic activity by having a more favorable tax climate. But like you say, you've talked to county managers. You know, in Wake County, where I live, they're having issues where foster kids are sleeping on the floor of an office building because they don't have anywhere else to put them. The strain is definitely there if you look for it.
So, Chris, Republicans have cut taxes and enacted a schedule for future income tax cuts, some of which may be modified, I suppose, as they begin to finally tackle the budget, which they haven't done yet. But putting a limit on income taxes in a constitutional amendment is meant to enshrine those cuts in some sort of cement to make them permanent. If they want to protect their, if Republicans want to protect their tax strategy from Democrats, who might have a different strategy should they regain control of the General Assembly, does an amendment really work? I know it's a little more onerous than passing a law, but couldn't Democrats turn around and repeal the amendment?
If they can get this 2/3 of the vote, and if they can get the people to vote in a majority to increase their taxes, yeah. But you know, I think that's, look, I'm a big WCU fan. I don't think the odds of them making the bowl championship series are pretty good this year, the national playoffs, right? Like, yes, you could do it, but I think for the people to vote for a tax increase is very unlikely. I think this is a very good bet by the Republican Party. Essentially what they're saying is, one, the policy they want, but it's also a branding exercise, right? I mean, you can see this in the Republican rhetoric right now. They're saying, which party do you want to be a member of? Which party do you want to support? The party that wants to cut your taxes or the party that doesn't want to cut your taxes? It is a very good talking point. I think the fiscal points you're making, Mike, are excellent, and the questions you're raising are the right ones, but as a piece of political strategy, it's pretty smart.
Well, Republicans say that their tax cuts have produced economic growth and budget surpluses. Mm-hmm. Is that true?
You know, I mean, look, the economy is one of these things where you can argue it from a lot of different directions. And I think the Republicans, certainly the facts they are citing on this are 100% correct, right? They are not making up facts. They're using the same thing the Democrats do, which is interested information. Essentially, you find the information, you find the facts that supports the outcome you want. And I think there's nothing they are saying that is incorrect. And I think the Democratic retort is largely less about, really, even if the facts are correct, but about who gets credit for it, right? You can see Roy Cooper certainly wants to claim credit for North Carolina's economy. At the same time, the General Assembly wants to claim credit for North Carolina's economy. Who's right and wrong, we'll never know. Who gets blamed, we're going to find out in November.
So this constitutional amendment is a way to cement their tax philosophy into the Constitution and make it more permanent than it is right now. It's also about maybe attracting more people to the polls. And when they come to the polls, they will vote for Republicans who are cutting their taxes, as you have just said. Chris, your colleague, Dr. Michael Bitzer from Catawba College, says that Republicans see the winds of political mood of the state against them and need high voter turnout to blunt Democratic gains. If that's true, and if you agree with that statement, is that totally due to Donald Trump?
I do agree with that statement. I make it a policy not to disagree with Michael Bitzer, and I see no reason to break that policy today. Is it totally due to Donald Trump? No. Right? This, like, we've known for a long time there are four things really that are bad for the incumbent party. One is just being in a midterm. We always have this kind of thermostatic response, right? It gets too hot, we turn it cold. It gets too Republican, we turn it Democrat. So we would expect, not knowing anything about who's running and who's in office, be a good year for the Democrats. You add to that a pretty bad economy, right? And you add gas prices that are through the roof. I went to get the door latch fixed the other day, and the guy said, well, let's see if we can cut you a deal. Gas prices are too expensive, right? This is getting through to regular people. You add to that this war, right? We know that people getting killed abroad really, really hurts the incumbent party and the party of the president. So you put all that in, and then you add Donald Trump sort of other less popular actions and opinions. That's four things all moving in the same direction. So yeah, this is going to be a good year for the Democrats. The question is how good, how big is the wave? And I think the Republican Party, by putting these amendments in, one, is trying to juice turnout in their favor through very legal and reasonable means, and two, again, to brand their party not as the party of this unpopular war of high gas prices, but as the party of low taxes.
Yeah, when everything's more expensive, and everything is more expensive, people want to save money wherever they can, and they would like to save money, Colin, they would seem to me, when their tax bill comes due every April. So that's playing in the Republicans' favor. But people also have their own personal budgets, and they know there are times when they need more money than others. And that this tax cap would seem to me to limit the options that the General Assembly would have, the state would have, going forward. Right now, we're taxed at just slightly above the 3.5% cap they're suggesting in this constitutional amendment. The current cap is 7%. Personal income taxes are scheduled to lower from 3.99% to 3.49% in the next several years, eventually to 2.49% in 2034. But don't voters have a say right now about how much they're taxed every time they go to the polls to elect legislative leaders? And doesn't that allow more flexibility? If you're going to elect somebody who's going to tax you more because you know the state's not building roads, that still gives you that option.
Up to that cap, certainly. I mean, as Chris pointed out, it's really hard to get people to vote for higher taxes in a direct democracy type fashion. So once you get the cap on there at 3.5%, it's going to be really hard to convince voters to go up to 5% if they elect Democrats, because they're generally unhappy with the state of budgeting, with the state of way state government's running. Those Democrats would have the power under current constitutional law to go up to 7%, but this sort of reins them in on that. Some of it seems to be a sort of admission that, you know, maybe at some point we do have a Democratic legislature and they want to go more in the property tax direction. But I think this is sort of forcing them to go other directions, whether that's to increase the sales tax or the gas tax or something of that nature, to raise revenue instead of going up on income taxes in the years to come.
And to be clear, this has passed. So this will go. This does not require the governor's signature and is not subject to his veto. So this will be on the ballot in
this
November?
Will. And it's an interesting dynamic for Charlotte listeners, because under this state, to get a constitutional amendment on the ballot, you need 3/5 of both the House and Senate to vote yes to put it to voters. That's more votes than Republicans have on their own in the House. But because two of Charlotte's House members, Carla Cunningham and Nassif Majid, who lost their Democratic primaries, have now left the party, become unaffiliated, they provided the key votes that Republicans needed to get to that 3/5 threshold and get these measures on property taxes and on income tax caps onto the ballot in November.
Let's talk about that constitutional amendment to limit property taxes, or the ability of municipalities and counties to levy certain property taxes beyond a certain level. Several years ago, there was a local initiative on the ballot here trying to get funding for the arts, but the wording was so innocuous that people didn't know exactly what they were voting for. And in the end, it was simply vote for this and we'll figure it out after you say yes or no. Well, people said no. And this is very much like that. This constitutional amendment for placing new limits on local property taxes, it simply asks voters if they are, quote, for or against a constitutional amendment requiring limits on property tax increases by local government. With that wording, is it sure to pass? And with that wording, is the General Assembly bound by the decision? Or can they just leave things well enough alone?
That's an interesting question because it is extremely vague. The plan is to pass the actual legislation that determines what the limitations would be after the election. So voters are going in saying, essentially, do you want to have some kind of limitation there without any knowledge of what that limitation would be? How stringent is it? What are the impacts on local government's ability to fund essential services if you do whatever the limitations are? You're kind of flying blind here as a voter, but at the same time, I think the general consensus is this is likely to pass because property taxes have gone up in so many areas through revaluation or through tax rate increases at the county and city levels that people are frustrated with their tax bills going up. So this is probably going to be popular from that standpoint. And it's at the bottom of your ballot. So you probably haven't done a ton of research about this. You're just seeing this, you know, one sentence question on your ballot and thinking, yeah, I do think property taxes are, you know, need to be put into under control. And then you're sort of giving this power to the legislature, but they already have that power. And there's other bills going through even this session, including a moratorium on property tax revaluations in a couple of counties. So legislators can do this, but now they're asking the voters, do you want to put it in the Constitution that we have to do this in some capacity or another?
Cabarrus County Republican Brian Echeverria has talked about the importance of not pricing people out of their homes, which happens, I suppose, when property taxes become too high for people, particularly on a fixed income or whose wages are not meeting their needs. But Democrats say that the reason some counties are finding it necessary to raise property taxes, which is the impetus for this constitutional amendment, is because the state is no longer funding required services at the level necessary, and they're stepping in to pick up the slack. And we've heard from local leaders who say that the state is failing to do their job. What has been the Republican response to that?
I think they've sort of looked at some of the examples where the property tax rates have increased suddenly. They've done it in a way that to some people seems sort of sneaky, where the rate doesn't change, but you did revaluation and now everyone's house is worth significantly more than it was last year and your tax bill goes up as a result of that. And then there's some local governments, Cary and the Triangle comes to mind as being in the news for misspending or overspending on certain things that can be seen as frivolous. So I think people look to that example. But at the end of the day, yeah, I mean, most counties are having to shoulder the burden of more social services funding or additional local funding for public schools that perhaps a few years ago they weren't necessarily seeing as much of a need for because the state was covering that.
Republicans like Grover Norquist, who have said that he wants to shrink government to the size that it can fit in a bathtub by cutting taxes, etc., are probably excited about this. But is this also a clash of simply political beliefs? Republicans like to believe that the private sector will step in and fund many of the things that the government has long done if the government stops funding them. Chris, is that true? Is there any evidence to say that that would happen?
I mean, I think they would argue there is, right? I think you're absolutely right, Mike. This is where kind of your partisan lens is going to determine what you believe about this. And we also know that more people tend to trust the Republican Party on issues of the economy. We can argue whether that's right or wrong, but that's sort of the reality. If you ask people on polls, which party does a better job on education, for example, they're going to say the Democratic Party. Which party does a better job on the economy? They tend to say the Republican Party. This is what we call issue ownership. And so the Republican Party isn't pushing against the grain. They're just trying to reinforce this belief that folks already have. So I think that's going on. At the same time, I think there's this interesting tension that's building between state government and local government. And sort of the way the parties deal with that has flipped.
Dr. Chris Cooper is a professor at Western Carolina University, where he's also director of the Public Policy Institute. Colin Campbell is Capitol Bureau Chief, right in the thick of things on Jones Street for WUNC. And we earlier heard from Gavin Jackson, host of This Week in South Carolina on South Carolina ETV, about what's happening there right now with their elections. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.